This is Jordan, and you're listening to the Code 7 Podcast Network.
Warning. This episode contains the three A's of podcasting: adult content, adult language, and awesomeness. You've been warned.
Welcome to Within the Trenches, true stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them.
Hey, this is Ricardo with the Code 7 Podcast Network, and this is going to be episode 139. Holy crap, I almost forgot what episode it was, and I'm looking right at it. I'm looking at my guest right now. I'm going to keep that in there because it's going to be funny for people to listen to it and hear me mess up. So this is episode 139 of Within the Trenches, and I am currently recording live from the 2017 Navigator Conference in New Orleans, Louisiana. And again, like I've been saying, thank you so much to the IAD for giving me the opportunity to come here and do this and do the show and hook me up with this booth. And, you know, this episode for this week, along with all the other ones, are supported by the IAD as well as InDigital, which is a leader in next-gen core services. So, a lot of things going on, a lot of good stuff. A lot of the people that were here earlier have now cleared out. About 12:30 is when the first class or first sessions were starting on this, you know, Wednesday, this opening day. And so everybody's in classes. The only ones left here are the industry partners who are just kind of chilling and waiting for more traffic to come through after classes are over. So I've got two excellent guests. We were already laughing and joking right before this. And you'll hear a little snippet from that in the beginning of this episode. Or actually, you should have heard it already. We're recording this now. But my guests today are the CEO as well as public relations of Wevo. So I have here Emily and David. How's it going?
Good.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us.
Yes. Yes. Definitely. Now, just a quick overview before we get into. Because we're going to talk about you know, your company and what you do and all, but just a quick overview of Wevo, and then we're going to go back in time in our DeLorean to learn a little bit more about the both of you, because you both have public safety experience. Emily coming from dispatch, David who is currently fire and paramedic. So tell me about Wevo.
So Wevo is an emergency contact system for your personal property that works directly with public safety dispatch centers. Mm-hmm. So a customer goes online to my website, they purchase some stickers, and then they put those stickers on their property, their house, their car, their kayak, bicycle, anything it can stick to. And on that sticker is a registration number, an identification number. So if there's ever an emergency with that property, or it's lost or stolen and then recovered and turned into the police somehow, dispatch can then log into my website using a department-specific login and password and run that identification number similar to how we run a car registration number, and then instantly be able to pull up that property owner's emergency contact information and then also secondary emergency contact in case they're out of town.
Nice. Excellent. So, and I'm guessing that all of this, you know, kind of also came from your background, was, you know, everything that you dealt with, maybe having an in-house computer or something.
Yep.
and different things that you dealt with when you were in dispatch.
Mm-hmm.
So jumping into that DeLorean and going back in time, let's start with you, Emily. How did you get into dispatching to begin with?
So when I was 18, I took an EMT class, EMT Basic. And while I was kind of waiting for that to come to fruition, I wanted to try dispatch. It was an integral part of how the whole fire service works, mm-hmm. and I wanted to see how it worked. So I applied. I was the youngest ever hired dispatcher for Brunswick. Am I allowed to say that?
Of course.
Okay. And
yes, you can say your agency.
Okay.
Shout out to whoever.
Yeah, Brunswick, Maine. So so I started working there at 18 still continued on with my EMT, and I'm an advanced EMT for the last 15 years, as well as being a dispatcher for the last 15.
Dang. So you went in early, and then you stuck through it all that time.
Yeah, dispatch and fire and EMS. I was on a volunteer department for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. That was kind of my college, really, until I actually went to college. But that's where I grew up. I grew up in that dispatch room, learning about life, basically.
What was it like for you when you had first started out there on dispatch?
Like, terrifying.
Yeah.
My coworkers,
tell me about
they would make me cry. I was so scared. because at that time we worked alone. Mm-hmm. So I was like, at that, so when I got off probation, when I got off training, I was 19. So I was 19, sitting at the desk by myself, working overnights. And it took a few years, I think, before I was comfortable enough to realize that I could handle anything that came in. I mean, I always did handle it, but where right. I was confident and not so scared anymore. But yeah, I remember at 19, I handled, you know, like car chases and structure fires and things like that. And it was always, you know, it's a lot to
right. Yeah. I mean, it can get pretty stressful and stuff, especially, you know, being, you know, 19, not that, you know, 18 and 19 year olds can't handle it or anything, but it can get intense. It can get crazy. I've always explained taking a high priority 911 dispatch call as being in the car, slamming the gas and letting go of the steering wheel.
Right.
It's that intense.
Yeah.
Not that I've actually done that in a car, but.
And it's like when you're by yourself, you have to, you're it. You are, there's nobody you can call. I mean, you could call your boss at 2 o'clock in the morning, but,
right.
You know, you are in charge of making that decision and it's like, you better make the right one.
Right. So, exactly. Yeah. So working by yourself, was that a 8 hour or 12 hour shift?
8 hour shifts.
8 hour shift.
If we had to use the bathroom, I had to call an officer in off the street to sit the desk so I could run across the hall, use the bathroom and come back.
Okay. So
I know
when I first started out, dispatching, I started out in Florida actually. And it was a small police department. Same thing. I was by myself for 8 hours. And I would have to do the same thing. I would have to key up on the radio and say, you know, frostproof to 108. You know, frostproof, go ahead. I'm going to be 10-7 down the hall for, you know, a few minutes. And then they would know. That's what I mean. I'm going out there unless, you know, I was saying 10-1 or 10-2 or code brown or something. And, you know, I got to go down the hall. Okay. And you know, so yes, I can completely relate to you being the only person on a shift and then having to use a restroom or something of that nature.
When I first started, I wasn't allowed to answer 911 yet. I hadn't been cleared to answer it. I would only listen when my partner would answer.
Right.
And my partner left the room to go smoke and he went down and we had a payphone in our lobby, but I couldn't see him on the payphone.
Wait a minute. You had a what in your lobby?
A payphone.
Whoa.
It was 15 years ago.
I know.
So he went down and he called 911 and I screamed. My lieutenant still can remember me.
That's
screaming
amazing.
To him down the hall because he was a reserve and he was authorized to answer the 911.
Right.
And I just screamed, Mike. And because I was too scared to pick up the phone because I didn't want to get fired.
Right, exactly.
Oh, it was awful.
Oh, some nice little hazing there going on for you.
Oh, so much hazing.
Oh, that is nuts. So you end up going through, you know, your training and such, and you're in there, you're by yourself, and you're still kind of freaking out, and you get, you know, those first few calls. What was that like for you then?
Oh, my goodness. I'm trying to remember. There's been so, you know, 60,000, I think, or so in my career.
Holy crap.
So
I've never really thought about the amount of calls I took in my career.
Yeah.
That's nuts to think. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many. I wish I had been writing them all down in a book this whole time because oh, my goodness.
Well, yeah, I can imagine. There's a lot of them that, I ended up blogging. So when I started doing all of this, I was blogging a lot of my calls. Ooh. So I have about 600 entries in my blog. Not all of them are stories, but a good amount are in there of stories and stuff that I did. So eventually I'm going to do the same thing and try to write a book and get my stories out there. But I mean, doing this, you know, recording all of these different dispatch stories, these are all going out there and people are listening and they're learning from it as well, which has been really good. Now, David, how did you get into being, you know, a firefighter and paramedic and all that? What did you have family that was in you know, like public safety and stuff, or was it just something that you really wanted to do?
It was actually something I just came across when I went to the University of Maine in Orono. They had a like an on-campus firefighting detail.
Okay.
So we would take part in the Orono Fire Department, be part of them, and be fire marshals on campus. So I saw a flyer, and I decided, why not? And that was pretty much how I started.
Nice.
I just decided why, you know, the wind was blowing that way that day, and I decided to.
Perfect. There you go. So you jumped right in.
Yeah, totally. I'm very impulsive that way.
So So you didn't have any other experience or anything other than maybe, you know, seeing the news or watching TV or something? I mean, you didn't do any sit-alongs or ride-alongs or anything like that? You just jumped right in.
Yeah, I mean, as a kid, I grew up on Long Island, New York, mm-hmm. and they'd bring the fire truck to the school like once a year. That was pretty much my only experience with it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It was probably something in the back of your head that made you, I think I want to try that. So
yeah,
that's awesome. So then when you were going through that, you know, how much training did you have to do? And you know, up to the point where you're at now in your current career?
The department did a lot of training with us to just get us acclimated to firefighting, work as a COAL member. So they had a full-time fire department there, and then we supplemented them. And we would go to campus and do extra COALs, especially during the middle of the night. Late night, fire alarms going off. They don't really want to send the whole crew because they know it's a trouble alarm. They would teach us to do those things. So I learned fire alarm systems very early on. But yeah, there was a lot of, I did an academy up in Maine. It was a 2-week academy. Just intensive 2 weeks every day.
As you're saying intense, what are some of the things that made it intense? Like, what kind of stuff did you have to do there?
It was actually July, and it was one of the hottest summers that we had on record for a while. So we would just do drill after drill after drill of going into the burned building. They hadn't lit it yet, but going into the burned building and dragging people out. So learning how to drag victims out constantly. You would just do this over and over for 8 hours the whole day.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so they've got these dummies that you're dragging out. How much did they weigh?
Oh, no, they were us.
You guys were dragging each other out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We were all wearing the air packs, and we would drag each other out.
No shit. Okay, well, the reason I ask is because before I had moved back to Michigan from Florida, our records department, the person who was doing all of our records, her husband was a state trooper there in Florida. And he kept telling me, you know, you need to go and, you know, apply. You know, they're looking for people to go in for the academy. I can, you know, probably get you in there, but you've got to pass all your tests. And I said, okay. So I went for the physical, and you had to do it in under 6 minutes, I think it was. And it was a huge obstacle course. And we had to do a dummy drag, and it was just over 100 pounds. Yep. And I'm dragging this dummy, and I was exhausted by the end of it. But in the middle of the drag, I got some crazy cramp in my leg, and I fell back. And when I fell back, I thought I had tied my shoes tight enough. Apparently not, because when I fell back, when I was going back, all I saw was my shoe going up in the air. And in my head, I was, what the F? I can't believe this just happened. I continued dragging it, and I ran back without my shoe. And I ended up making it with a really good time.
Good job.
By the end of it. But
shoeless.
I know. Yeah, exactly. And one of the guys who was there, one of the lieutenants, he walks up and he goes, Martinez, you showed a lot of heart. And I was like, thanks. And he goes, you need to eat more bananas. And I said, what? Then he goes, yeah. He goes, you need more potassium, man. He goes, that's why your leg cramped up. And I thought, oh, thanks. Thanks, man. I appreciate that. So I ate a bunch of bananas later on. And I have been eating bananas ever since because my leg ended up messing up. So you go through all your training and stuff, and then you start running calls. Now, how long do you stay, like, probationary?
At a full-time fire department, mm-hmm. when I started on, let's say, Brunswick, down mm-hmm. south in southern Maine, it was a year. So you're on probation for a year.
Okay.
And you're still doing everything with the crew. You're still doing all the same things. It's just there's a lot more responsibility put on you. You're doing a lot more than the other guys do because they want to make sure that you can do it all.
Wow. So do you have to remain, like, a shadow?
Yeah, actually, it is one of the expressions where we say, you really shouldn't be heard your first year. We should be seeing you do things.
Ah,
nice.
So
that's true.
Do everything, you know, be inquisitive, ask questions, and really just try and take it all and be a sponge, soak it all up.
Nice. So this was fire. How about the paramedic side then?
Well,
or is it like an all-in-one that you're actually
It's an all-in-one, actually, because the way the system works, I'm a hazmat tech, I'm a confined space tech, an ice rescue tech, I'm an ice rescue instructor, a paramedic, a firefighter, one and two, an instructor, a CPR instructor. We just don't have the funding to hire enough people, so we're always understaffed, and we just, you know, we're doing everything.
So you're a hybrid employee.
Yes, extremely.
You wear many hats.
Oh, yeah. And on one day, there's no set position. I mean, we have a position when I come into work. I'll be, let's say, riding in the back of the fire truck, but I'm also on the ambulance at the same time. So I, if an ambulance call comes in, I do ambulance. If a fire call comes in, I do fire.
Wow.
There's no delineation. Interesting. Yeah, it's all merged.
So you're talking about, you know, also, you know, instructing for CPR and stuff. Do you use the same thing that a lot of other people do and say that staying alive is the perfect beat for when doing compressions?
It was a few rounds ago, about 4 years ago, but they've changed that now.
Oh, they have?
Yeah. Yeah. And everyone keeps, you know, and when I teach classes, like staying alive, I'm like, actually, it's a little bit faster than that.
So what song do you guys use now?
Actually, we don't use the song. We use metronome. So,
oh, okay.
Like,
well,
even
that
the
works.
AEDs have a metronome on them.
Much
so it works
more exciting
great.
Than...
Oh,
I don't know. I think I'd rather have staying alive.
Yeah,
to be
absolutely.
Honest.
Right. Or right? Another One Bites the Dust, because it's the same
perfect.
Rhythm.
Right, exactly.
A little dark humor there for,
oh, yeah.
for people.
I can't tell you that's never been said at a scene.
Right.
Oh, dark humor? Oh, my God.
Oh,
yes.
My God.
Yeah,
exactly.
We live in it.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to survive somehow.
Exactly. And I actually, let's see, this was about a month ago. So, actually, a few months ago. So, I ended up. Shout out to Mike of Sword and Scale podcast. He had me on one of his episodes talking about dispatch, and he played 9-1 tape, and I was explaining all these different things about dispatch and such. And so I ended up getting a lot of his listeners were listening to mine as well. And there was someone, I'm not sure if it came from that group, but there were a lot of new people who were listening. And one person had tweeted out to me saying, "You joke way too much about stuff that happens to people." And you know, I don't remember what episode it was that she listened to, but I will play 9-1-1 tapes sometimes, the outrageous ones, mm-hmm. not the like serious ones. I don't make fun of any of that stuff, but those outrageous ones were like this one specific. A lady calls in about her two young daughters who are fighting and bickering and stuff. And she's saying that one of them is as big as her and she can't handle her. And the dispatcher says to him, kind of laughing, "Well, do you want us to go out and shoot her or something?"
Oh, God. Yeah, I've heard that.
And she goes, "Excuse me?" And he goes, "Oh, that was a joke." And I completely understand there are some families that, you know, have children that have, you know, certain medical issues or anything like that, that they do need help like that.
You got to know your audience, buddy.
Right. And, well, see, and I explain that every time, too. I don't make fun of stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the other stuff that's just like outrageous and stuff mm-hmm. that, you know, dispatch gets, that's what, you know, we end up commenting on. And this one person was saying that. I said, "You don't understand. You know, we need dark humor to be able to get through this." And then after I gave my explanation, there were tons of people who were also tweeting this one person explaining dark humor and saying, "Just don't listen," and all this other stuff. And I thought, I didn't even have to say anything because the listeners ended up saying stuff for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, that dark humor, you know, the general public doesn't understand that part of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's for our own sanity. We need to go home at the end of the day and be normal people, or
right.
try at least.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what about some calls or maybe some runs that you guys have been on, you know, ones that kind of stuck with you, either, you know, good, bad, funny, anything that comes to mind?
Probably one of the funnier, it's not going to start out funny, so just bear with me. This guy called me, and it was February, we live in Maine, it was very, very cold, it was like below zero for mm-hmm. about a week. So this guy calls me on Friday and says, "My mom is on hospice." I know, this is not the funny part. "My mom is on hospice."
You say hospice, I'm like, just gasp.
I know. So she's on hospice, and we're going to be removing her feeding tube, and she's probably going to pass away this weekend. Mm-hmm. And in Maine, anywhere, I guess they have attended deaths and unattended deaths.
Okay.
So where, you know, if somebody has cancer, they don't have to call us and tell us that they've passed away. But if it's, you know, unexpected, they do have to call, and we have to investigate. So I said, "Well, you don't need to call us and tell us. You just can call a funeral home and they'll come pick her up."
Right.
"And you need to call her doctor, blah, 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 blah." So he calls me the next day and says, "Well, I got up at, you know, 10 o'clock and she had passed away. And I, you know, I made some breakfast. I cleaned her off. And now I want to know if I can put her in the back of my pickup truck and keep her there all weekend and drive her to the crematorium on Monday myself."
What?
And I said, "Sir, I don't think you can transport a dead body without some type of permit." Because I don't, I mean, deers need permits if you hit them with a car. So
right, exactly.
He was trying to save money because a funeral home coming and picking her up and bringing her to the crematorium is like $500. It's pretty expensive.
Yeah.
But this cheap bastard wanted to stick her in the back of his pickup truck because he knew it would be cold.
Because it's cold outside. Yes, exactly.
Cold enough for her to keep and drive her to Portland, which is like, you know, 35, 40 minutes away. And all I kept thinking to my head is, what if he crashes his pickup truck and she flies out the back?
Oh, my God. Can you imagine?
How would he explain that to the trooper when they got there, that there's a dead body? Or he gets pulled over.
Right.
And there's a dead body in the back of his truck. I mean, it would just be a disaster. But you know what? There was no law that said he couldn't do it. So he stuck her in the back of his pickup truck.
Good to know.
No way.
And drove her to the crematorium on Monday. Because apparently Maine missed that. Oh. There's a loophole in the Maine law books about transportation of a dead body.
That is interesting.
Loophole or benefit for people that want to be cheap at their own funerals.
Right. I said, yeah, exactly.
This your mother, dude.
Right.
You're going to stick her in the back of your Ford F-150. Are you going to, like, wrap her in a blanket at least? I mean, I know it doesn't start out funny, but that's one of my funny
parts. But that's a good one. That'll probably be part of the, if I ever do any greatest hits of this podcast, that story.
Well, you're welcome.
Yes. No, that is, how did the call end then?
I sent an officer to the house because he wanted to make sure that there wasn't anything weird going on.
Right.
This was a weird question.
Right, exactly.
We're starting out, you know, this conversation didn't start out very well. So the officer went out there and obviously she had died of natural causes. And he's like, we consulted the higher ups and I don't think the officer helped put her in the back of the truck, but
right.
he left and said, you know, I'm sorry for your loss. And I was stumped on that one.
Right.
It was a long time ago. I was still pretty new.
Man, that story makes me think of the original National Lampoon's Vacation.
Yeah.
Yes.
When
they put her on the top.
So they put her on the top and transported her like that and then just dropped her off.
This was real life National Lampoon.
Wow. Yep. That's a good one. I like that. Thank you for that. That was a good
one. You're welcome.
Now, David, how about you? Any calls that you can think of that kind of, you know, stuck with you or
beat
stuck
that
out?
Oh, yeah.
I know, right? Follow that one.
I guess most of the calls that stick with me are not humorous. So I did have something. I mean, this is one of those jobs that still, for me, I find surreal.
Uh-huh.
That still surprised me.
Right.
I don't think you can ever really, like, go to work and say, oh, I know what's going to happen today. No one knows.
Yeah, exactly.
And I had a patient that we got called for respiratory distress. Mm-hmm. We go there. We go into this apartment building. A nurse meets me at the door. Legit nurse, not like someone calling CNA nurse. Legit nurse.
Right.
She goes, she has a breathing problem. She fell. And I think she might have broke her foot. I say, okay, no big deal. Go into the bathroom. She had slipped. I'm looking at her foot. And it has a sock on. And it's backwards and bent up. Like the toes are pointing towards the knee. Back
what?
Of the knee.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, oh, you know, broken foot. Treat the respiratory distress. Takes a while. She's quite large. We're working on it. She's a gem, too. I mean, she was just wonderful to us, you know, talking to us.
Yeah.
Decide to handle the foot. We handle the respiratory at this point. And, her foot was severed.
What?
So when she went and came out of the bathroom, she slipped, and she must have had her toes down. And it snapped her foot back. And
off.
Yeah, and she had very big pedal edema. And it was kind of like, I guess, equate to maybe a sausage bursting from the casing.
Oh, man.
And it didn't just break and spin back. But
yeah.
It, like, spun around. So it was attached by the slightest ligament. And that was it. Just, like, the tiniest bit. I mean, like, to a point where it looked like a piece of string.
How do you treat that, then?
Well, and here's the strange
thing. Do you just cut that little ligament and say, here you go?
So I actually
this cannot be saved.
I know. Well, and the thing is, like, the strangest thing is I'm thinking, oh, well, what do I do with this? So I just spun it, like, kept unspinning it until I could get it back to, like, where the ligament should be and then just put it up and kind of tied it together. with wow. like boys. But the weird part was
like a Boy Scout.
Yeah, and I was not a Boy Scout, but I know my knots. The craziest part was is like she didn't bleed out, nothing like that, because she had a sock on, and the sock, when spun around, created a tourniquet.
Oh.
So when I took the sock off, it had already, like, clotted. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I couldn't have had the best scenario for that, so. It was
that
great.
Is crazy, though. Yeah. And the it spinning around makes me think of, like, Daffy Duck, you know?
Oh, yeah, with his bill.
Right, yeah. Yeah, when Fudd would, you know, shoot him and stuff, and it would go around. That's the first thing I thought about when you're talking about the foot like that.
Oh, yeah.
Holy cow. See, and those are a lot of things where, you know, you can take a phone call and such, and if you don't know that information, or even if you do know that information, you can only use whatever, and sometimes your imagination is worse than what is actually there, but to be there on scene and have to deal with that and, you know, figure out at the end of it, oh, this thing is actually, like, severed.
Oh, yeah.
What are we going to do now?
Well, and the crazy thing is, like I said, I'm walking in for a respiratory distress, and I end up with a severed foot.
Right.
And she was so funny. I finally looked at her, and I go, dear, I got to tell you. So I don't know how to tell this to you, so I'm just going to say it. Your foot's off. Like, you don't have a foot anymore. I said, I don't know. She wasn't screaming, and she had diabetic neuropathy, so she didn't really feel it.
Oh, man. Okay.
And she looks at me. She goes, honey, I've lived long enough. If you feel the pain that I've had, this is nothing. She goes, I don't feel it, so good enough. And I'm like, that's a great attitude to have.
Yeah, exactly. Well, here, let me show it to you now.
Yeah.
This is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's crazy. You know, I took, now that you're talking about medicals and stuff, I took a medical call once where a gentleman called in, and I've told this on the podcast before, but an elderly gentleman calls in because his wife is having difficulty breathing. And I can hear her in the back kind of wheezing and stuff. And he's talking about how, you know, she has a trach. But he starts laughing. And I'm thinking, dude, your wife is, like, not able to breathe. I've got EMS going priority one to get to you. Why are you laughing? And I had just asked, I said, sir, why are you laughing? What's going on? And he goes, my wife, he goes, the other part of this, he goes, my wife cleans the tube out with a wire brush. And the reason she can't breathe is because it broke off, and it's inside the tube. And I still thinking in my head, why is this still funny? And he goes, I told her that was going to happen. I told her not to do it, and it stuck. I guess at that point, he was just like, well, what else am I going to do but laugh at the situation? So I end up.
I don't know, pliers?
Well, he does. He ends up asking. He ends up asking that, and I told
this
EMS
is why
this.
I never want to get married.
Why? Because people are going to stick wire brushes down your throat?
Yeah.
Wow. And it's going to get stuck. Or because you're afraid that your husband would be laughing at your expense.
Right.
I don't know.
I'm at respiratory distress.
Right. Well, I tell EMS that this is going on, and their response was just, oh, okay. And, you know, they get out there, and they check on scene as he's asking and laughing still, should I get some pliers to take this out? And I went to answer him, you know, and they said, we're on scene. I was like, no, hold on. EMS is there. They're going to go help you out. And he's like, he's like, all right. He goes, have a good one. I said, you too, man. And she's still kind of wheezing in the background. I thought, man, that's nuts. Where else would stuff like that happen but in dispatch?
Oh, my God.
So segueing now back into Wevo. So you've got, you know, all these stories that you've told and such, and, you know, your experience in public safety and all of that. You know, really, why did you want to start this?
So in dispatch, we are constantly taking calls where we need to get a hold of a property owner in an emergency and we don't have their information. So, like, for example, in Maine, we have a lot of bodies of water. So in the summertime, we get reports of, like, floating kayaks in the bay, unmanned. So we don't know if there had been somebody in the kayak and fell out, or if it just had blown off of somebody's dock or camp. So we have to send the Marine Patrol, the fire department out with their boat to go search the area to make sure they don't see any life vests or, you know, anything like that. So a lot of people don't mark their kayaks or paddle boards, canoes with their information. So we don't have anybody to call. We can recover the kayak, but then we don't know if somebody's in the water. And so having a Wevo sticker on your property is just a really fast way for dispatch to be able to run the identification number and call that kayak's property owner, and ask them, did somebody have that kayak out today, or was it just sitting on your dock and float away, or, you know, drift away? The other thing is we deal with a lot of homeowners that there's an emergency at their house. There's been a vandalism or burglary, a chimney fire, things like that, where the fire department, police department has to make entry to the residence and then then the residence is unsecured because they had to break the door to mitigate the issue. So if we've never responded or you've never called the police, we don't know who lives there. We don't know who you are. We can't take the time to rifle through your bills to find your cell phone number and call you and tell you there's a problem at your house. So again, it's just a fast way for us to be able to call you and let you know that there's an issue.
That's awesome. That is really cool. Cause when I was in dispatch, I live just about 10 or 15 minutes away from Lake Michigan. And we would get calls like that all the time. So we've got a vessel that's floating out and, you know, everybody would be going full charge to go, you know, figure out what's going on. Or, you know, they would just be driving by one of the, you know, smaller lakes and see something floating and they pull it up, or somebody would call, say, you know, I found this, and there'd be no information. We don't have any information at all. And we would have to wait for someone to either call, or hopefully we had a similar incident with the same type of thing, you know, description and such. So we would know who it belonged to and stuff. So having something like that is freaking awesome for dispatch to be able to use as another resource to help them do their job. So well done.
Yeah, like we have in our bike rack, we have a paddle board that's been there since last summer. It flew off somebody's car driving down Route 1, but so if they don't know, the property owner doesn't know where they lost the property, they're not going to spend the time calling every agency between where they started and where they ended.
Right.
So, and the paddleboard doesn't have a serial number, so they couldn't report it lost or missing or stolen and not entered in DNCIC. So we've just had a paddleboard in our bike rack for a year and a half waiting for, somebody to...
So then take me into the process really quick here on, a customer... They get this, and do they just go to the website and fill out all their information to be added to a database, or how does it work?
Yeah, so I have two. I have an e-commerce website where customers go to purchase the stickers, and then I have a database. It's the same database that dispatch has access to. So I have to manually enter the information that they provided me into the database, and along with the identification numbers that I've sent them. So the customer goes online, they purchase the stickers, and then I take that information, put it into the database, assign them their stickers, and then mail them out. And then they just put the stickers on their property. And for now, that's it. Eventually down the road, I'd like to be able to, I'm doing the website in phases because it's a very expensive process.
Oh, yes.
And, eventually I'd like to have a website where obviously the property owner could log in and make changes to their account information. Because right now they have to just send me an email and then I can go in and enter and change the information for them. And then also down the road, be able to have customers able to upload pictures of the property that they have the stickers on.
Perfect.
And then also serial numbers of the property they have it on, if it's like a laptop or cell phone or camera. Because that's another problem we find in dispatch is, like, say something's stolen from a car or a house, your laptop's stolen. Most people have not taken the time to write the serial number down of that laptop. So it could also be basically like an inventory control system for their own personal property through my website.
Perfect.
That's later on down the road, but that's where I'm headed.
There you go. That's awesome. Well, going into the wrap-up of this episode, where can the public find you? In social media, Facebook, Twitter, website, where can they find you?
Yeah, social media, Facebook. I do have a Twitter, although I'm not very well-versed in the Twitter world.
The Twitterverse.
I know I need to, the Twitterverse. I need to be better at it. I know I do. So right now I'm mostly on Facebook, and it's just Weevo, U-I-V-O. And then I have a website, www.weevome.com. So U-I-V-O-M-E.com.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you both very much for being on this episode.
This was
a lot of fun.
I'm taking you to dinner.
All right. There we go. this was a lot of fun. And this, you know, you were saying this is one of your first big national conferences, and I wish you both a lot of success. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. You're going to be a big part of it, I think.
All right. Awesome. Well, for those listening, if you have any comments, questions, or you want to email the show, you can send an email to WTTpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, and that is @901podcast. You can like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/withinthetrenchespodcast. And this episode, along with all the other episodes this week, are supported by the IAED. As I keep saying, I sound like a broken record. Thank you, IAED, so much for giving me the opportunity to be out here and hooking me up with the booth. And, we've been working together, partnering on sharing, our links, different stories that we're doing and such. So thank you very much. And also, this episode is sponsored always by, or supported rather, by InDigital, which is a leader in next-gen core services. And this episode, along with the others, can be heard 24/7 on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio, and thejabberlug.com. Have a good one, everybody.
You just listened to a Code 7 Network podcast. If you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to wttpodcast@gmail.com.